is in four sections. Now turn to section one. Section one. You will hear a conversation about a language course. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. You will see that there is an example that has been done for you. On this occasion only, the conversation relating to this will be played first.
Good morning, Borgheimer Language Courses. How may I help you?
Oh yes, I contacted you some time ago about following a German course in Germany, and you advised me to take your placement test before we go any further. Well, I've done that now, so I'd like to go ahead with booking the course for this summer, if that's possible.
Certainly, sir. You said you took the placement test. What was the result?
I was placed at the O3 level.
O3. Right. That's lower intermediate. Fine, Mr.
The answer is level 3 or lower intermediate. So the course level has been filled in for you. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 5.
Pettersson, John Pettersson.
Could you spell that for me, please, Mr. Pettersson?
PETTERSSON.
That's a double T and a double S. Am I right?
That's right. Now, could I ask you where the course takes place?
Well, we offer courses in Hamburg and Berlin. For your level, there's never a problem. There are always plenty of people for the intermediate classes.
Oh dear, does that mean that there might be a lot of students in my class? I wouldn't be very happy about that.
No, don't worry, Mr. Pettersson. The maximum class size is 12, but I've never known there to be more than 9 or 10 in a class. It could even be 5 or 6.
Good. Actually, I'd prefer to study in Berlin. And how long is the course?
3 weeks, 5 hours a day. 2 hours only on Saturday. Sundays free.
I see. And what about accommodation?
There you have a choice, Mr. Pettersson. You can either stay with a German family, who are used to having such guests, or you can stay on the university campus, or we can book you into a nearby bed and breakfast.
Is there a big difference in price?
Not really. Staying with the family works out the cheapest, and the bed and breakfast is a bit more money. Staying on the university campus comes somewhere between the two, price-wise. But Berlin is not too expensive anyway.
Which do you recommend?
Well, if you want to practice your German and be part of a German family, I would recommend staying with a family. Our families are all hand-picked, and we've never had any sort of complaint.
Yes, I'll probably do that then. What are the dates of the course?
The first summer course starts on the 1st of June in Hamburg and a week later in Berlin, which is what would concern you as you have chosen the Berlin course. That's the 8th of June. The next course would begin on the 2nd of July and then...
The 2nd of July course would be perfect for me. Can you put me down for it now?
Certainly, Mr. Pettersson. Can I have your address, please?
26 Mayfield Drive, Orpington, Kent. I'm afraid I can't remember the postal code.
Don't worry, Mr. Pettersson. I'll check on it.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 6 to 10.
There are a couple of other things I'd like to ask.
Certainly.
What do I need to bring on the course?
Well, apart from the obvious, you'll need our textbooks. I'll email you the name and publisher. You should be able to find it in your local bookstore. If you do have problems, call me or email me and I'll see what I can do. We provide the computers, computer disks, translation exercises and all that sort of thing, but you will need a good dictionary. We recommend Langenscheidt, which is more than adequate for your level. You don't have to go and spend a lot of money on an expensive dictionary. Not yet, anyway. Maybe you will when your German reaches a very high standard.
That would be very nice. Now, finally, what about the cost of the course? And how do I pay?
Would you like to pay that in pounds or in euros?
Euros would be fine.
In that case, it's 550 euros. You can pay by credit card if you like.
Oh dear, I'm afraid I haven't got a credit card. How else can I pay?
That's not a problem, Mr. Pettersen. You can pay by bank transfer.
Fine. By the way, I forgot to mention I am a full-time student.
Have you got a student card?
Oh yes.
Then that does make a difference, you'll be pleased to hear. You are entitled to 35% off the full price. And if you can persuade a few people to join you, it would work out even cheaper.
How do you mean exactly?
Well, for every 5 people you find, 1 goes free. In other words, if there are 6 of you, you get 1 free course. Of course, in reality, you would divide up the savings amongst you, presumably.
Right. Well, I'll see what I can do. Thank you.
Not at all, Mr. Pettersen, and I'm sure you'll enjoy the course. There are, of course, sightseeing possibilities. Would you like me to send you our brochure describing them?
Yes, thank you. I'd appreciate that. Anyway, thanks for your help. If I want to call back, who do I ask for?
Susanna. I'm here most of the time.
That is the end of section one. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section two. Section 2. You will now hear a radio talk on agricultural regulations. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 15. Could there be clearer proof of the arrogance and indifference of those who are supposed to keep our food safe than the muzzling of John Verrill? Agriculture is a business, true, and businesses have to make money. But this shows how ministers and officials put the profits of the agriculture business before the well-being of the British people. Mr. Verrill, a pharmaceutical chemist, was appointed to represent consumers on one of the many committees that advise the government on food safety. When he tried to do his job, though, and wanted to warn ministers of a danger to children's health, he was refused permission to do so. The danger comes from hormones given to cattle in the USA and some other countries to make them grow faster. They speed up the animal's development to maturity, thus making meat production more profitable. There have, however, long been fears that the hormones have horrendous effects on the people who eat them, causing diseases as serious as cancer. Once these hormones were used on British cattle too, but over 20 years ago they were banned in Europe for being too dangerous. Indeed, so concerned is the European Union that it banned imports of hormone-fed beef years ago, much to the fury of the US government, which wants to sell it all over the world. Several years ago, the USA and Canada asked the World Trade Organization to declare the ban illegal and to punish Europe for failing to lift it. The WTO, with its long record of refusing to let environmental or safety concerns interfere with trade, agreed, imposing fines of more than $120 million a year on the EU for its refusal to back down. The British government now backs the Americans, claiming that there is no proof that hormone-fed beef does any harm. This is where Mr. Verrill comes in. He is very angry with the government, especially as their claim comes out just after a Danish study shows that growth hormones are 200 times more dangerous than was previously thought. Worried by these findings, Mr. Verrill spoke to government representatives, who did nothing. Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20. Not only that, but they have not been testing beef which is imported, which, by law, they are required to do. This directly affects the British public, as about 40% of the beef British people eat comes from abroad, supposedly from countries like Brazil, which does not allow the use of growth hormones. Brazilian beef is stocked by some British supermarkets and widely used in catering. Yet, when a Brazilian farm was recently visited by EU inspectors, a large stockpile of this banned substance was found. This is not the first food scandal we have had in our country. Take the present concern over a well-known chocolate company. Several months ago, the company found out that its sweets were contaminated with a rare form of salmonella, but they did nothing about it, leaving their sweets in the shops to be bought by the unsuspecting public. It was not until 5 months later, when several children had suffered food poisoning, that the chocolate bars were removed from the shelves. It makes you wonder how many other dangerous foods have been allowed onto our plates. That is the end of section two. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 3. Section 3. You will hear a conversation between a tutor and two students, Amanda and Jake. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
So, Jake and Amanda, how did the project go?
Very well, I think, Dr. Hinton. I certainly learned a lot and enjoyed myself at the same time.
Me too.
So, remind me, what was your project about?
Basically, what makes successful people? Let's call them top achievers, successful.
Yes. How are they different from us? What do they do that other less successful people don't do?
Interesting. And did you come to any conclusions?
Quite a few, actually.
Good. Share some with me, then.
Well, I'd always thought that a top achiever would be the sort of person who would bring work home every night and slave over it. But it appears not. Those types tend to peak early and then go into decline. They become addicted to work itself, with much less concern for results. We found that high achievers were certainly ready to work hard, but within strict limits. They knew how to relax, could leave their work at the office, prized close friends and family life, and spent a healthy amount of time with their children and friends.
There's a lesson for us all there. Anyway, go on.
It's also very important to choose a career which you enjoy, not just one that pays well or which assures you of a pension many years down the line.
Surely that's important though, Amanda.
Yes, I agree. But being happy in your work is far more important than anything else. Top achievers spend over 2/3 of their working hours on doing work they truly prefer and only 1/3 on disliked chores. They want internal satisfaction, not just external rewards such as pay rises and promotions.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now, listen and answer questions 26 to 30.
Actually, in the end, they often have both, because they enjoy what they are doing, so their work is better and their rewards higher.
Yes, Jake, that certainly makes sense. Now, can I ask you something? Do high achievers, as you call them, take many risks?
Yes and no. I interviewed one business executive who told me he was able to take risks because he carefully considered how he could salvage the situation if it all went wrong. He imagined the worst that could happen, and if he could live with that, he went ahead. If not, he didn't take the chance. Other people prefer to stay in what I heard described as the comfort zone setting for security, even if it means settling for mediocrity and boredom too.
Would you call top achievers perfectionists?
Contrary to what I expected, no, I wouldn't. We came to the conclusion that a lot of ambitious and hard-working people are so obsessed with perfection that they actually turn out very little work. I happen to know a university teacher, a friend of my mother's, who has spent over 10 years preparing a study about a playwright. She is so worried that she has missed something, she still hasn't sent the manuscript to a publisher. Meanwhile, the playwright, who was at the height of his fame when the project began, has faded from public view. The woman's study, even if finally published, will interest few people.
So, what has this got to do with top achievers?
Well, top achievers are almost always free of the compulsion to be perfect. They don't think of their mistakes as failures. Instead, they learn from them, so they can do better next time.
Well, would you call them competitive?
High performers focus more on bettering their own previous efforts than on beating competitors. In fact, we came to the conclusion that worrying too much about competitors' abilities and possible superiority can be self-defeating.
Yes. And we found that top achievers tend to be team players rather than loners. They recognise that groups can solve certain complicated problems better than individuals and are eager to let other people do part of the work.
Yes. Loners, who are often over-concerned about rivals, can't delegate important work or decision-making. Their performance is limited because they must do everything themselves.
Well, it looks as if you two have done a thorough job and learned something into the bargain too. Now, there are just a couple of points I'd like to clarify with you.
That is the end of section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 4. Section 4. You will hear a talk on seasonal affective disorder. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
In the past few years, a new condition has been identified and given a name, SAD, short for Seasonal Affective Disorder. This is now recognized as a distinct kind of clinical depression, where people become depressed at the onset of winter, accompanied by a craving for sweet things, causing weight gain. Each spring and summer would then bring on almost maniacal highs and feelings of boundless energy and happiness. Experiments to combat this depression showed that increased exposure to bright light in humans could suppress their production of a darkness-related hormone called melatonin. The light needed to induce this change was about 2,000 lux, or about 4 times brighter than ordinary household lighting. It was then calculated that if bright light could suppress melatonin secretion, then it might have other effects on the brain, including the reversal of symptoms of depression. While melatonin's precise role in SAD has not been pinned down, the theory led to effective treatment. Not surprisingly, SAD affects more people where winter nights are longer and days shorter. In the UK, an estimated 500,000 adults develop full-blown SAD in winter, and twice this number suffer the milder condition called subsyndromal SAD. About 80% of sufferers improve when given light therapy, and improvement usually comes within 2 to 4 days. Scientists are still unsure why winter depression happens, but more than a decade of research has turned up some surprising findings. Nearly 80% of SAD victims are women. Researchers are uncertain why this is so. SAD can affect people at any age, but typically it begins around the age of 20 and becomes less common between 40 and 50. SAD is comparatively rare in children and adolescents, but so far researchers have been unable to come up with a logical reason for this. As many as half of SAD sufferers have at least one family member with depressive illness, suggesting that the depression has a genetic component. Some patients experience shifts in their body clocks when they're depressed in winter. They are morning people at one time of the year and become evening people at another. What is the underlying difference between SAD sufferers and others? A clue can be found in carbohydrate craving, a common symptom. People often become obsessed with chocolate, for example. Carbohydrates alter brain chemistry by increasing the level of a soothing chemical called serotonin, a neurotransmitter that carries signals between brain cells. SAD sufferers crave carbohydrates because they may need serotonin to lift their mood. This craving can be intense, in fact, an addiction. It may be that the serotonin system of the brain has problems regulating itself during the winter. Some SAD sufferers respond well to the drug Prozac, thought to influence the brain's serotonin-using system. Other brain chemicals and hormones probably play a role in winter depression. Another neurotransmitter, dopamine, for example, may be inadequate in certain cases. Researchers hope to uncover clues to SAD's secret by probing similarities between SAD and hibernation. Though no valid link between the two has been established, some SAD patients say they feel like hibernating animals. SAD sufferers tend to put on fat in autumn and early winter, roughly the time when such hibernators as bears and squirrels do.
That is the end of Section 4. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers.